The following episode of Beyond the Border was recorded live at KURU, Gila Members Community Radio in Silver City, New Mexico, on November 26, 2024. Beyond the Border is a monthly feature of the weekly program Tuesday Morning Beat, where we provide an opportunity to broaden our discussion about death and dying, and in reflection, how we live our lives each day. We will explore how we could enhance our understanding and acceptance to embody autonomy and dignity, even as we approach the end-of-life journey for ourselves and others. The discussion will include end-of-life options, personal narratives, shared experiences of the universal process that we all someday will face, taking perspectives of social justice into another, less explored dimension. We are all walking each other home. For more information, contact DJ host Mary McHugh at maree@gmcr.org. Thank you for tuning in. This is Tuesday Morning Beat. My name's Mary McHugh. I'll be with you for another hour with my wonderful guests, Scott Plate. He's my co-host on this series, Beyond the Border. Scott is a death doula, a life coach, and a very intuitive and dynamic interviewer on the subject of death and dying. I'm having so much fun doing these shows with you, Scott.
I'm loving it. And thank you again for your generosity in opening up an hour a month to this subject matter.
Yeah.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah, we have to thank Gila Members Community Radio.
Please do.
Let me introduce Siri Dharma Khalsa. She has lived and worked in Grant County since 1997, originally from Toronto, Canada. Her first close contact with death was at 15 years old when her father died suddenly. It upended her world. Working at Gila Regional Medical Center Home Health and Hospice Department for 4 years was one of the greatest learning experiences of her life. Getting lost in the Gila wilderness, getting lost in the Gila on Mother's Day was an eye-opening for her about fear and that being prepared is the ultimate tool. Also, being a yoga and meditation teacher since 1978 has given her a perspective of the depth of the human spirit, which fueled a desire to help people to face the inescapable fact of life. Dying is inevitable.
Thank you so much for joining us. I first want to say thank you, Siri. When the idea of this radio program first kind of dawned on the horizon, you just reached out with such enthusiasm to want to be a part of this.
Well, radio is just a fabulous way to communicate to a bunch of people.
I agree.
And people be able to sit home and listen just in their PJs. You know?
Exactly, which is kind of what it is, yeah. First of all, I think there's a typo in your bio. I think getting lost in the Gila was actually in 2005.
Yeah, it was in 2005.
Oh,
So we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of this on Mother's Day.
Interesting.
I've
wanted to try and go back to the place where I was lost, so maybe I'll just get a couple people together and do that hike on Mother's Day.
And sing, I was lost, but now I'm found. As for our listeners, this is a conversation about death and our approaches to death and how our real life experiences often prepare us. And I know that preparation is a very important practice for Siri as a result of an experience she had in the Gila wilderness back in 2005. Could you give us a little bit of background about what happened on that day? Because I think it's a powerful story.
Wow. It was, so my partner and I usually went out to either Turkey Creek or the Box. Mm-hmm. We lived in Gila. We'd spend the day just wandering up and down the rivers. So this particular Sunday, we went out, I don't know, about 11 o'clock or so with our dogs. And we were walking up the river. He plays with
And one dog was a lot older, as I recall.
Yes, this was one of the parts of the end
one
of it.
One of your senior citizen dogs.
One of my senior citizen dogs.
Yeah.
And so, as we just played in the river, took a lunch, you know, had a good time. And as we're walking back, I decided to go around a bush that I thought I would just meet them on the other side of this bush. But the bush went down to the river. So I thought, oh, well, I'll have to cross here because I have to cross later anyway. So I crossed and I thought, it's a little deeper than I know it is upstream or downstream a bit. And I got to the other side and then, I don't know this. But anyway, I headed in the direction that I thought my partner and the dogs had gone. And the next thing I knew, I was facing the confluence of two rivers together. And I said, God, I've never been here before. Okay. And I couldn't go anywhere with those, the way they were coming together. So I turned around and I looked around a bit, and I tried to go back to where I was, and I thought, and I started calling the dogs because I thought the dogs could
hear. Was the sound of the water a hindrance, getting your voice across? I'm just trying to picture the place.
That's possible. I didn't even think of that at that point, but I did start calling the dogs as I moved back, and then I started looking around the area a bit, still calling the dogs, thinking they could hear me, because I wasn't, the thing is, it wasn't, you know, right in the middle of the wilderness. I was about a mile from our car, and I think... And then, so I thought, I knew, and I had, I knew my partner was around somewhere, but I got completely discombobulated. I went a few yards some way, this way, and then that way, and around, and I looked around. I came across a path that was very well traveled, and I thought, okay, but I didn't know which way to go on the path. So it was, I knew that this was one of the trails through the wilderness, and I thought, okay, but do I go right, do I go left? Because by that time I was just getting a little, like, what's going on here? So time went on, and a few hours was passing. I got hoarse from calling the dogs. I looked at the path again. I wandered around. I thought, well, I'll cross back where I was, and then I thought, well, no, because maybe they're gone by now. Where are they? And then I thought, well, I was very unprepared. I had shorts on, a t-shirt, I had a small towel with me, and a little plastic bottle of water, which I ended up filling up with river water. And I knew, too, a little bit about, you know, going downstream and going upstream, but I would even look at the river and not know which way to go. So I was just getting a little fearful and discombobulated.
Naturally.
And then, so as the evening was coming, I didn't have matches for a fire, and the sun was starting to go down, and I thought, well, where the heck am I going to spend the night? And I got very scared then, because several years prior to that, I'd had a physical nervous system sort of breakdown where I was, and a friend had been saying to me for a while, you're not walking quite right. And then one day I stood up and I couldn't make my legs move. I just was stuck. So that took a few years to work out. But when I thought, oh, I might have to be here the night, it got very fearful, because I thought my nervous system's not going to be able to handle it. So I thought, do I sleep by this tree? There was actually an old piece of machinery even hanging around, and I thought, do I go and sit on this old tractor? What do I do? And I'm still going around in circles, and eventually I heard my name being called. And so it was my partner had arrived, and he was on a hill across the river up high, and I was going, I'm here. He said, come on, come across the river, come on up the hill. And I was so scared at that point. Mm-hmm. I said, I can't get through the bushes to get to the river, can't cross. And so he came down the hill, and I have called him since then my knight in shining nakedness, because he had to take off his clothes, he crossed the river, he held his clothes above his head, came up, got me, looked at me, shook his head, grabbed my hand, and started going back to where the car was. I don't even remember that part of the trip, but it was the whole thing was just very fear-inducing for me.
I can imagine. How many hours elapsed between the time you went around that bush and when your knight in shining
probably
nakedness
about
showed back up?
Five, six hours. We usually left in the afternoon about 3:30 to get home, and since it was Sunday, I knew I was going to work the next day and stuff. So we'd go in the morning, leave in the middle of the afternoon, and so about 8 o'clock that night, 8:30, I think he made it there.
So you were losing light.
Oh, yeah, by the time. And I literally, you know, he had to hold my hand to guide me across the river back to where the car was. That took a while, too.
Well, and I think what you had shared when we were talking about this is the reason he had left was because he was concerned about your older dog making it out. So he went to take her home.
He went to take the dogs home, feed them, and he knew he couldn't. He said he waited for about an hour for me to come along. And since when I didn't, he took them home, fed them.
He figured you couldn't be far, so he would come back. So that's, first of all, an incredible story. So there's a couple things I'm curious about, and help me. So let me know, if you can, what it felt like to be so close to where you knew you had just been and yet not be able to recognize anything.
That's the most discombobulating feeling, because I knew, again, I even knew that the dogs were close or that they were close. But what was more. It's like you sort of forget that. But when I got to the river, when I got to places I knew I'd never seen before, mm-hmm. and yet I thought I was going in the right direction towards where they were, but I was completely not anything I'd ever seen. So I was turned around by then.
Nothing looked familiar.
Yeah, nothing looked familiar. So, and I wasn't prepared.
It's such a paradox to be right where you know you should be, but have no idea where you are.
Right. And I think that's what happens when you're coming close to death. That's what started me on this really, journey, the inner journey of dealing with the fears, dealing with what comes up that is discombobulating, that scares you, that's like, okay, how do you deal with that? And being prepared is certainly one way.
Well, I think in a way being unprepared really underscored the need ultimately to be prepared. So it's such an... I have so many questions, so I'm just going to kind of take them one at a time. So when you first there's this point where you realize that you're right next to where you should be but don't know where you are. When does the fear of I won't get out begin to take over?
Well,
I
knew I would get out eventually, but then you don't hold on to that. I didn't hold on to that. I just said, well, where am I? And the fear got worse when I remembered the situation with my
nervous system condition, right?
Because it's a physical thing. It's not, my mind wasn't going, nervous system wasn't going. It was like my body stops and sometimes it just tremors. And because that happened, I knew sort of staying overnight, that as it was getting darker, as time went on, it moved to, okay, well, how do I do the night here? You know, I have a towel. Sure, I could lie on that. Where do I lie on that? Do I sit up? What critters are around? All that started taking over. And the fear was, oh, it's going to trigger that whole nervous system thing I had several years back.
Wow. So another question. So during the fear building, mm-hmm. what did you find you had faith in, if anything?
Goodness. What did I? Well, I had faith in that I knew that my partner knew where was I.
That was
somebody
a given.
Knew where I was.
Okay,
so
that's good.
I had big faith in that.
Someone knows where you are.
Yeah, someone knows where I am, and they will be here eventually. I didn't think much about what they were doing. I was just saying, where the heck are they? I didn't even think that he had taken the dogs home. It just didn't cross my mind.
Sure.
Because then it wasn't about them. I just had to figure out how to deal with this unknown.
It strikes me that he had enough faith in you to take the dogs home and then come back.
Well, yeah, I guess.
But that's what's interesting to me is, you know, there's a part of him that said, okay, for an hour,
right.
she'll be okay. I'm going to go and come back so I can really search for her unencumbered.
Right.
And take away all the things that would get in the way of having the experience, the things we have to take care of, dogs, you know, administrivia of our lives, because the real story here is finding you.
Well, and the real story is how I turned this into, like, I, having felt that kind of fear, I just knew, and I guess it was later, I didn't think about it much after I got over it, until later when I was working in hospice and mm-hmm. I was seeing that kind of fear coming up in people's mm-hmm. faces and situations, that it was like, okay, what did I learn from when I was fearful that mm-hmm. I can apply here? And it was the whole concept of being prepared. I mean, if I'd had a way to build a fire, if I'd had long pants and a sweater, something, mm-hmm. it would have been just much easier.
So what does fear help you to do, and what does fear hinder you from mm-hmm. doing?
Well, it certainly hinders you from thinking much beyond it.
Okay.
Even with all the years of practice of meditation and stuff that I've had, it took me a while to just sit down. I mean, I don't think I really thoroughly sat down and got calm mm-hmm. in those hours. But it certainly made it like that's what you have to do in order to deal with fear, is just get to a point that you can sit and try and be still and try and calm yourself down enough to get the fear mm-hmm. spread out smaller. Something.
Right. I think in my experience, fear is imagination about the future.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Overactive, very often, imagination mm-hmm. about the future. It keeps us from having this experience that we're having. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, fear is almost like a buffer.
Sure. If you don't want to think about somebody, the thing is fear triggers you, in you. And so then you have a reaction in your mind and your body. Mm-hmm. And my mind and my body were very separate at that time. And I hadn't maybe experienced it to that degree. And I'm very conscious now of really bringing back when you get in a sort of fearful situation. Your fear is either about the past or the future. In the very moment, if you can sit for a second and come to that moment of just stillness, you're right in the present. So that takes just a bit of time to...
And practice. Well, I think in a way, you know, to give you some credit, you just had a nervous system issue that made you have a little less faith in your body's ability to cope and work. So you were concerned on behalf of your body for this.
Absolutely. On behalf of my body, I wasn't worried that they were worried where I was. I was worried about, oh my God, my body's not going to be able to handle this night in the wilderness. And I've camped a lot in my life. So it wasn't the outside, it wasn't the trees, it's trying to figure out how I'm going to do it. But it was like, oh, my body's not going to handle this well.
Well, we've talked in some of our programs here about the, you know, supreme challenge of birth and death. Will my body be able to be what it needs to be in order to accomplish what I have to accomplish here? What do you imagine, given your experience in the Gila, death is?
That's a great question. What I imagine death is, what I'd like it to be for me. And I think that death is completely different for every individual.
I
think
agree.
We all die and we all do it differently. And there is no escape. So what I'd like to do for mine is to sort of come to the end of it, say, oh, it's here, turn around, say goodbye, and walk through. So I'd like it to be as conscious as possible. Because my fear is the coming up towards death.
Yeah.
It's not the after part. It's not the being of the dying. Doesn't seem to be what people fear there. It's more like what happens before, which is my big fear, the pain, you know, not being able to deal with pain. It's like a
loss of control, right?
All that stuff. And I'm not really worried about what happens after. That's a whole different kind of story. So that's what I imagine. That's what I try to imagine is like just a nice, conscious coming to the end. That might not happen, though. I mean, that's what being prepared is you might not get what you want. So you have to be prepared for, okay, it's not going to happen the way I want. What do I do now?
Okay. Fabulous. So question about, you said walk, come up to the end, turn around, say goodbye, and walk through. Walk through what?
Well.
And into what?
My vision of it is it's a veil. It's just, and for some it's more transparent than others, and
like
for some
fog,
it's a wall,
like a mist or fog.
Oh, probably, yeah. I kind of see it as a curtainy kind of thing coming down, and I'm just gonna sort of either part it with my hands or just I'll see. Oh, yeah, it's coming.
That's a very common image. We often hear that, like in poetry and literature, and maybe even in meditation. I've said this before when we were interviewing someone else about death, about a friend of mine. Her spiritual teacher told her that death was like when the soul leaves the body, it was like a silk scarf being dragged across a rose bush.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Because there's these beautiful scented petals and there's thorns that will catch the fabric also.
Right. You're holding on to your beliefs. This is one thing. I think you're holding on to your beliefs. You're holding on to the love for your family and your friends. There's a holding on that happens. It's very hard for people to give up. And I think it's helpful when people tell them it's okay to let go. And that, in facing fear, that's hard to hear. You have to sort of face your own fears. Somebody can't tell you, oh, don't be afraid of that. If you're afraid of it, you're afraid of it. And you're going to have to figure out some way to deal with it.
One thing I want to share is, first of all, it's a great question and just reflection, Mary, about how that veil is such a part of our iconography, you know, as we move from one place to another. But I'm always interested in, when I work with clients, is what they imagine is happening to them.
Right.
And for some people, imagination is a big part of, you know, because we talked about fear being imagination about the future. Imagination is a big part of dying, it seems to me.
Very much so. And it's funny because you reminded me, I was in a conference once, and we used to do meditations at the beginning of the conference or in the middle of it. And one of them was a meditation on dying, imagining what your death is going to be like. Mm-hmm. And so mine, of course, was, you know, it's going to be, I'll be in a bed for sure. I don't know. But mm-hmm. I'll be near water and I can look out and beautiful music, but I'm in a bed. And a friend sitting behind me, and they asked some people to tell them what people saw. And he said, well, I'm skiing down a hill in Vermont. And I went, what? I had never even conceived of dying in an active kind of mm-hmm. way. And so that kind of just really blew my mind. You can figure out many different ways you might want to die or could die. And maybe, you know, maybe you'll be able to choose it that way. But it's... there also will become all this unknown will come towards you. Mm-hmm. And then how you deal with that
exactly.
is the important part.
Well, the word through is an important one. Fortunately, you gave us so many resources to prepare for this interview, and I'm so grateful to you for that. There's one was a compendium of things that you have developed and assimilated and integrated throughout your life, ways to live until you die. And there's one that's number 9 that says, pick a fear and walk right through it. So again, I'm drawn to the word through. So I look at the journey through the Gila, the lostness. Mm-hmm. I look at our life as a through line.
Yeah.
So how would you help someone who might be afraid think of their life as a preparation?
Well, I, you know, I see that a lot with people and know people that are facing stuff that just is discombobulating to them and they don't know what to do with it. And I think take your own hand kind of and say, okay, mm-hmm. If you've got the time, this is not when you're in the middle of a trauma, but take your hand and just think of some small thing that you are fearful of. Mine, and I'll use mine again, was skating, for instance. I used to skate a lot as a kid, being a mm-hmm. Canadian. And then as I got older, it was like, oh, I don't think I can get back on these skates and go out there. But I tried it once, and I had help, and I had people around, and I had buffers on my legs. And that you just try to go through it gently. Take yourself through something that's very uncomfortable. Instead of blocking it, turn it around so that, okay, I'm going to try and face it as best I can. And I've always seen, every time I've tried that, once you get on the other side of a fear, mm-hmm. it's not nearly as bad from the other side. It's not nearly as bad as you imagined it to be.
I think you're talking about something really important, because there's one, what you're saying is be gentle with yourself and go through it. There's other people who, I just have to get through this.
Right.
You know, I'm going to clamp down. I'm going to imagine the worst. And I'm going to shut myself off from having any kind of absorbed experience of what's going on to me. And that, in my experience with fear, that adds to it.
I think so too. I think the difference between tensing up and facing something like hardcore and just, okay, I'm just going to try and relax. I'm going to breathe. I'm just going to calm down a bit as much as I can and move slowly through something as consciously as you can helps. I don't think it's an easy thing to do, but I think it's easier on you if you're tensing up your body all the time because of the fear, or closing your heart or holding yourself tightly, then you're missing some kind of opportunity for help.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody may be able to help you go through that. And just relaxing and learning how to, it's like turning how to take deep breaths and mm-hmm. learning how to calm down and find your pulse and realize you're in the present moment. That helps relax you and face something more easily.
You've used the word conscious, you know, a few times when you talked about your own kind of walk up and walk through. Hopefully for you, it will be a conscious process. What's your sense of how consciousness changes our experience of fear?
Well, just in that way I'm saying is being conscious means you're taking control of yourself. If you say, I'm going to look at this as widely as I can. I'm going to analyze it as much as I can or figure out what can help. Then you're more open to going forward. You're prepared with, okay, I've got some knowledge about what's going on here. I've got some help over here. I'm just going to try and move through it. And I think consciousness is, in my opinion, just better and easier in the long run than shutting down.
Another point that I'm drawn to is number 11 here. It's be creative in your problem solving when it comes to things that you're afraid of. and end-of-life issues. It seems to me that what you're saying is consciousness allows you to broaden the lens and perhaps be creative and imagine.
So, well, that's what, don't, I mean, once you close down and start getting fearful, being creative is very hard. And then, and I think for some of the artists that I know, and I'm looking at Mari, is if you can start writing or just drawing or just letting some of the energy out that is locking up and churning around inside you, let it out in some way into the physical world, that you're going to feel more relaxed, feel a little less. I just wish I'd had that capability through my life when I've faced certain things.
It's transformative.
Okay.
What you're doing is you're transforming. It's a transformation of this, mm-hmm. this pent-up energy, fearfulness. I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I'm in a conundrum. Right. Okay, you're going to start writing for people who are writers or poets. Right. And then if you're an artist, whatever your medium is, it's like if you can let go enough,
right.
you know, to grab those pencils or the scissors or whatever, the paints,
right.
you can transform it.
Yes.
That's, and that's, I think really that's word. That, I mean, that's what art does
mm-hmm.
for
yeah.
us in so many ways, whether we're the observer or the person who's creating it.
And that's a good point, because I've never considered myself an artist. I love music and everybody, and I have a block about it. I don't know where it came from, but I know that I've got to draw somehow in order to get through that block.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to approach it from, okay, I'm going to attack this problem, not harshly, but just like, okay.
You have a consciousness map. That's your art form.
I don't know what a consciousness is.
I'll tell you all about it later.
Okay.
I'm loving the conversation and the reflection on consciousness maps. The thing that strikes me is that I had a teacher work with me named Ernest Morrow, and I owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude. And his expression as we work together is, our life is what holds us while we have all of our experiences. And it helped me reframe my sense of my life out of, I tend to think my life is what happens to me. Those mm-hmm. are the series of events. But actually, those are simply circumstances. Getting lost in the Gila was a circumstance. The nervous system, you know, malfunction was a circumstance. The entire time, what I'm getting from you, Siri, is that your life was holding you as you began to accumulate this compendium of wisdom, this compendium of experiences that's now contributing to what Mary is talking about, a consciousness kind of map. So your art is your expanding consciousness.
Mm.
So I will bow to you for that, because I sense I've known you to be an aware kind of person, not just aware of yourself, but aware of other people's experiences. So I want to kind of take a moment and just recognize that out of fear has come this wonderful open wilderness of consciousness, which feels sacred to me.
I think it's sacred. Some people don't like that, but I've got to, and I have to say this, because somebody, for instance, as an example, talking about afterlife. So I think everybody has a very different view of the afterlife, what mm-hmm. could happen after. I think some people have very, very strong beliefs about how it's going to unfold. And I had that kind of, I had a picture of what it was going to be. And a friend of mine, dear, dear friend, who says, no, you know, when I die, that's it. There is nothing more. And I'm going, okay, I don't believe that. But I was starting to, it sort of got me. But I thought, I'm going to look at that again, looking at a fear. I wanted there to be some kind of specific path that was going to happen after I died. And she said, nope, I died. That's it. And so I looked at it. I don't know how I came to it, but I thought, oh, okay, maybe that's true. I'm going to just hold it in me that maybe something that I don't believe is really going to be what happened. And I thought, well, but it really made me stop and go, I got to open my belief system, even at our age. And I think it's really important to dig into our beliefs, really look at them strongly and figure out what's really true and resonates for you and what maybe you can drop, and then just keep to the point where it's just, you're open to almost anything that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, for me, one way of dealing with fear. If I'm open to an experience, then the strangeness of it won't blow me away.
Absolutely. And I think if you look at it from that point of view, everything is energy. And so what you're talking about is repurposing the energy of fear.
That's a good way to put it.
Or transforming, to use Mary's word, the energy of fear.
Or taking that veil and just like,
mm-hmm.
veil be gone. <You know? laughs> I don't know.
Well, watch your foot walk through it.
Yeah.
I think there's that old expression, you know, you are what you eat, right? So we also are everything that happens to us.
And everything we believe.
Right. And I've just finished saying life is what holds us while we're having our experiences and we're not all these events. But we are, we do metabolize these impressions and they become part of our consciousness. Mm-hmm. But then I think the cool thing about dying is I get the paintbrush back in my hand. I get to say, not I have to get through this. I get to say, what do I want this to be?
What do I want it to look like? Right, exactly.
So, and with when I work with clients, I encourage them to be as generous as possible with their vision. I can't imagine having a more generous vision starter pod than the Gila Wilderness, yeah. Which is an incredibly powerful. So questions keep coming up to me, and I'm going to kind of pop them out. When we're looking at lostness, we also think about, for what comes to my mind is GPS, right? I look down, you are here, and you know where you are. But as you zoom out a little bit, which is I hear you saying, sort of broadening, relaxing, breathing a little bit, being patient and gentle with yourself through this little dot on the line's intense experience. So that GPS vision becomes a kind of inner compass. So what guided you, do you think, when you look back on it? And what's not so much then, although that was the starting point, what has guided you?
Since then.
Yeah.
Because of the fear and then working in hospice and seeing how people die and mm-hmm. learning how to be very silent and just still with it and not insert myself into somebody else's life or problems or mm-hmm. death.
Because we all want to help, right?
Because we yeah. all want to help, and yeah. but you can help by just the stillness that and being silent.
Right.
Can reverberate out. So what do I think?
What kind of inner compass developed for you as a result of that experience? Because I think about sometimes I look at that dot on the line of the GPS and I feel it in me because I think, okay, I am here. What does that mean about what guides me from there? When I'm in a car, I look at the GPS, I see its progress on that dot on the line.
Yeah, but I still don't trust that car GPS. So, you know, what are you going to do? I trust me still way more than I trust some of this new technology, like being driven by a car.
Oh, that's a big leap for me too. Yeah.
But that's kind of it. Are we being driven and drawn forth by our beliefs and following that path, or are we being? I would say I'm more pulled forward by trying to understand and help whatever is in front of me, and however it goes. I don't know where I'm going to die. I don't know how I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. But I can be open. I can have techniques for keeping calm. If I get discombobulated again, like I was in the Gila, I could go, oh, no, no, just you know how to sit. You know how to figure out just to be in the present and then look at it again. So it's almost a unrolling of yourself and leaving some of the stuff that doesn't matter behind, not taking everything with you. This whole concept of that a lot of people are going through now of decluttering and mm-hmm. the Swedish...
Death cleaning. Right.
And it's been so incredible for me to take a house and get rid of two-thirds of the stuff and move into a few rooms mm-hmm. and just have... I still have too much, but it's that kind of letting go of all the stuff that we've accumulated. Kind of you accumulate this stuff all through life and your ideas and your beliefs. And as you get near the end and the path gets narrower, that's what I see it getting narrower, then you're letting go of stuff at the same time and still trying to look forward. I think there's a lot of things that happen in that period as you're learning how to go forward.
Oh, I think so too. Mm-hmm.
It's something you said earlier sparked a question for me. Scott, you said when you're with a client and you're guiding them through the death and dying process, acceptance, helping people to let go of fear, I realize that the people who are in a position to have a death doula or an advocate or a friend or a loved one, a volunteer from End of Life Options or hospice who can mm-hmm. be there with them. Mm-hmm. I think that the movement of End of Life Options is growing, but it's still not the norm. And that what you mentioned just sounds like, oh, wow, I want that for me. I want that mm-hmm. for my sisters, you mm-hmm. know, and my people. But at the same time, I realize that those options are not necessarily out there in the world. Can we talk about that for a few minutes? Yeah,
sure.
Because you both have been so strong in that movement in this community.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think hospice was one of the deepest experiences of my whole life, my best work experience because it's so filled. And then when this end of life options came, and I knew Adrienne Dare from before other justice, social justice movements, it is my first feeling about it is that it's a huge privilege that we in our American and North American and Northern kind of consciousness can have that choice, because the rest of the world can't. And I would, you know, people are dying every minute in wars and in horrible situations caused by other people. They don't have a choice. They don't have a moment to decide how they're going to die. They just have to survive until they do die. So I'm very, very strongly want to put that forward, that the feeling of privilege that we have these options. And the option isn't just New Mexico medical aid in dying, which is incredible, but we can choose, and we can come to a dignified death, and we can come to a path that we're determining for ourselves, which is not able to be happen elsewhere in the world at this time, and it's not getting better.
And for our listeners, End of Life Options, a nonprofit organization in the state of New Mexico. Other places have similar organizations like Compassionate Choices. And that's what it is essentially, is the opportunity for people to learn what options are, to have support, not only options in dying, but getting ready to die.
Well, and that's just
a lot of education.
A lot of people won't be able to access medical aid in dying, because whatever their process is, whatever is going on in their lives,
sort of
not going to happen.
Them out.
But everybody's still going to be facing that end. And as the path gets narrower towards that end, how are you good? You don't have the option to utilize our law.
And that's I think that's the purpose of the organization. I'm glad you brought it up, Mary. It's to broaden the conversation about, because the point of the program is to explore the idea of death from a social justice perspective. And I think very often what that boils down to is informing people about agency and choice, understanding that in order to respect the life that has been holding me while I've been having all these experiences, I have options. And I can choose to do A, B, C, D. Now, people may have philosophical differences with certain choices, and that's okay. No one's advocating for anyone to do anything other than just simply be aware of what you have in front of you. And that also helps with the fear piece that you were speaking of earlier, is I feel sometimes when I'm afraid that I have no choice but to go through this one way. Relaxing, breathing, being gentle as I approach this array of options in front of me. Let's me at least pick one up, ponder it, put it down, consider this with the support of friends and reflections of family members around me. Because I think ideally it is a participatory process.
Absolutely. Well, that's a whole part. The conversation that I think is an essential ingredient to facing the end of life. You've got to have that conversation with your children. In hospice, in training volunteers in hospice, there's an exercise where you do role playing. And I remember thinking that, I don't want to bother my children with my death. I don't want to talk to them about it. I'm not going to, you know, I'll just deal with it, and they don't have to be involved. And I took the role on in this thing of being the daughter of somebody who was going to be dying. And at the end of that exercise, it was like I was so angry and so upset that my mother had not told me that what was going to happen to her and what was going on with her. And I thought, okay, I have to now immediately change my belief about what I'm going to do in my family and with my own children, and started talking to them about it. So using the conversation, as you're saying, fear is either what's going to happen before you die or what's going to happen after you die. And if you can take that moment and just sit with it and come to recognize your own fears, and then then extend the conversation out to your family or your friends and start talking about it, so it's not something that you're just doing inside yourself, I think is a huge step that needs to be taken, and I'm watching people take it. And the first time I tried it with my kids, they said, no, our father just died. Don't you dare talk
don't
about
want to bring
your
this
death.
Up now,
we're not talking about it now. So you wait a couple of years, and then you talk to them later. But having all these little things that you can do to make it, to take your fears outside of yourself or to resolve those fears is really huge.
And I think what I'm hearing you say also, Siri, is just really – part of dealing with fear is embracing not knowing
right.
in some way. So
right.
I don't know, as we don't know what's going to happen at the end of our lives. Right. I don't know what's going to happen 10 minutes from now, quite frankly. And
exactly.
if anybody told me that they were, well, if they were clairvoyant, perhaps I would believe them. But the thing that's interesting to me is if I can embrace the very principle of not knowing, then whatever happens is okay.
Right. That's really true.
So many people, I think most of us, proceed from a question in our lives, and that question is, am I okay? And usually that comes from a place of lack. I don't know if I'm okay, so what I'm going to do is do things that are comfortable and familiar to make myself feel okay, even if those things are not necessarily good for me.
Right.
Sometimes we have relationship patterns that are familiar, if not healthy, food addictions, or whatever you want to say.
Give me an ice cream.
So the question that would... Right, for sure. Coffee with chocolate chips.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
mine. Okay.
And
my husband knows. He's like, bring some. Here it is. I'm like, thank you, Haagen-Dazs. I think the interesting thing is if we can be okay, just say to myself, not so much am I okay, but what if I just assume I already am?
Right. Right.
So in the wilderness, hard to do that on Mother's Day in 2005. I'm okay. I'm okay.
But it was there. There was a spot in my brain that said that. I know I'm okay, but it didn't, all the pieces that I carried in my brain, the thoughts I had and what I knew, were not coming together in a whole. And I think that's what fear does. It just
discombobulates everything.
Everything.
Well, the thing that's interesting that I want to kind of come back to is you did say, I remember asking you a little earlier, what did you have faith in? Mm-hmm. And you said, I knew that somebody knew I was there. Okay, so let's fast forward out of the Gila. Who do you imagine knows you're here as you approach your death?
Well, I know my kids are here.
Okay.
I know I have friends.
Okay.
I know that I like my belief system.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we bring mm-hmm. it back to. Like, I think we really need to look at our beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the talk about social justice, political justice, what's going on in the
world. I was kind of hoping you'd go here.
is making us, it's forcing us to really look at what we believe, what we're willing to accept, what we're not willing to accept, and deal with it. And I think that that's my personal opinion of why we've got what we've got now, is because it's showing us the underbelly, the darker side of what our democracy has been
mm-hmm.
Carrying for quite a while, and
mm-hmm.
that we have to see this. It's like we have to look at our fears. I
mm-hmm.
believe that. We have to look at the crap that's in life
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and, you know, not just sort of shun it, but kind of go, oh God, it is part of my existence. And we have that privilege of being able to look at things closely and examine things. And really, that's not happening other places. When other people are, when you're being controlled by some other force and you don't have the freedom to think, even, let alone, and we do. Not only think, but plan and choose what energy we're going to approach life with.
I agree. And I think, you know, it could be argued, you know, maybe controversially, but that in this most recent election, most people voted with some modicum of fear,
mm-hmm.
whether you were blue or red. They're
mm-hmm.
voting against what they don't want because they're afraid of that result.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that you're inviting us to look a little deeper into what is part of what it is that we say we don't want, and figure out what part of that is us.
Right. Look, yeah.
There's no point in othering anybody.
Right. We've all got pieces of many things that
we
are
do.
Part of us. And we've all developed very deep beliefs or feelings about things. And the problem is holding on to those. We're watching the other side hold on and not want to let go of power. We're watching men, no, apologies to the
mm-hmm,
men I love
mm-hmm,
in my life.
All right.
Hold on to that male power and that hierarchical being that we've had for so long out of fear. It's fear underneath that. It's
mm-hmm.
fear under all those people who are screaming and yelling at us about, you know, how wrong we are. So it comes back to looking at fears again, and looking at beliefs. It's like, okay, yeah, I got to check that out. Why do I like hate that thing over there? What is it about it that bothers me so much that I'm fearful?
I think sometimes, you know, in my experience, you know, what we're afraid of is what people think of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally realized that it's okay just to let people be wrong about me and go on about my business, because it enables me to see them You know, I think the opportunity we have in front of us, and I think you're getting lost in the wilderness, is a really great metaphor for what, in a way, where many people are trying to understand right now, is we're at a place where what we thought was familiar isn't really anymore. What we thought was familiar. And we have to own that this is our circumstance now. And what can we learn from it?
Right. And we could, in fact, be in this place that is a very uncomfortable. We don't like. It's going to be like this for a while. Oh, my God. Well, how am I going to deal with it? And find positive ways to deal with it as opposed to negative ways to deal with it.
And there are just as many people, if not more, who voted who are really happy right now with these circumstances and with these results. And we have to honor that as well. I understand.
Yeah.
And but I think the opportunity is whether we like it or whether we don't like it, this is the story.
This is the reality.
This is our life, which is holding us while we're having the experience, however we want to define it.
Right.
So what I love about your reflection about consciousness as we approach death, or the idea of death, is how can we expand to include all of the variables and assume that none of them are a problem?
Right.
Because they're just things that happen.
Right.
This is an event.
And that's what when I talk about looking at fears, is that's what you're trying to do, is you're trying to figure, okay, what do I really fear? And sort through your fears and your beliefs and look at them closely. We have the opportunity to do that, and we're privileged in that opportunity.
And we have a responsibility once we identify, then to be moving forward, taking a look at the larger picture, because it's what's going down is not necessarily just about us.
Mm-hmm. And it is. It's a world thing. I know one of the things I do when I'm in fear, and I'm like, can't understand what's going on, is back off, back out, off the world. You mentioned that. Mm-hmm. It's just in the GPS kind of way, back away, look at it from outside the planet. Is there more going on out there? Can I stand back and take a big look at the bigger picture as opposed to the nitty-gritties?
I agree with you, and I think that fear very often is the inevitable byproduct of being really closely identified with what's happening, and we lose the ability at that point to zoom out. Mm-hmm. I'm always kind of struck by Neil Armstrong and the astronauts who landed on the moon and walked on the moon, looking at the Earth from the perspective of the moon, thinking about the conflict, the strife, and all the things that bedevil us when we're here, just feel from that perspective so
minuscule.
Unimportant.
I've gotten that feeling from scientists, too, and people that really do examine things bigger and more unknown things. They always seem to have a little smile on their faces, this is incredible. A little bemused.
Well, I think in a way that's where the best death can be the best teacher, because it's the ultimate zoom out, right? Can we look at this death piece of our lives as a teacher and say, okay, should I really be afraid of being annihilated by what I'm experiencing right now? And then ask that question of my death, as Carlos Castaneda writes in, you know, Teachings of Don Juan. Invariably your death will say, no, there's nothing that will compare to this accomplishment, this experience that we're facing and we're approaching. So zooming out, needs to involve death in a way.
Oh, it has to. I think that I find it absolutely fascinating that there is no choice in this, and that we're all going to experience it, and it all happens differently. When I've taught yoga and stuff and meditation, is like the first thing that happens when you come onto this planet Earth, this beautiful place, is you take a breath.
Mm-hmm.
And the very last thing you do before you leave this planet is you take a breath.
Mm-hmm.
So the breath that we have that we take for granted is the thing that keeps us alive.
Our prana.
Prana.
Yeah.
It's a life force. And so getting in touch with that helps you with your fear too.
And go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say, and to remember that people who are really locked in day-to-day survival, are they going to live through the day? Are their children going to be okay?
Mm.
I want to go back to this privilege. You know, we do have the privilege to be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And with that privilege comes responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And how we can uplift to unburden people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we can be for the greater good.
Well, and I
sounds kind of Pollyanna, but
No, I think we have to. It is a responsibility, and that's a responsibility we have with the kind of democracy that we have. Is we've been given these freedoms. We've been given, you know, it's been manifested throughout all of the times that people have been trying to be free. That's what this whole country started on. But the whole country also started on, in its search for freedom, annihilating another group. The annihilation of somebody else because they're dangerous to you. If we had come to this land as immigrants, which we all are, and said to the natives that we met, "Hi, I'm here to find out about this place that you live in. Can I share this place with you? Can I learn from you?" How different would our world be? How different would that have been? So getting rid of this annihilation, like we've got to get rid of these people so that we can be happier. We've got to plow through here and destroy the land so that we can build what we want, is really led us to this strange place where we are now.
Mm-hmm. And here we are. I'm so delighted to share this conversation, Beyond the Border. Just in closing, Siri, anything on your mind that we didn't get to talk about in the last hour?
Oh, goodness.
I'm sure.
You know, so one thing that's been very important for me to learn is how to come into the present moment. Mm-hmm. And I find for anybody that is lost, if you can just find your pulse, if you can just put your fingers on your pulse, either in your hand, your neck, your groin, that's your lifeblood running through you. The minute you feel that, just remember you're right here, right now. And this is your life. And immediately, you're not thinking about the past. You're not thinking about the future. You're not thinking about your problems. You're just here. So I encourage everybody to find out where their pulse is. And just every once when you're getting a little nervous or tired or weary or
just
scared.
Just tune in.
Just feel it.
Being at the bedside for people who are dying. You know it's going to happen. It's imminent. Person is passing. And it's just instinctive to reach out and put my fingers on that pulse. On that pulse.
Mm-hmm. Right. And feeling for the last
and feeling for the last beat. Right. Wow, it's so beautiful to spend this time with you.
One last thing I wanted to
yes,
share.
Yes, we do.
Is one thing that I was struck on the list of things that you would love to accomplish or just be mindful of as you approach death or live your life is to share yourself. Mm-hmm. You talk about whatever circumstance you're in your life to be able to share yourself. And mm-hmm. So I would like to just thank you for sharing yourself today. So if you're in a space where you can be generous with your experience, what you're encouraging us to do is to make it possible for others to have theirs
right.
by being present.
Right.
And so thank you for your presence today.
You. Thank you for having me. It was great.
It was wonderful to have this conversation.
And thank you to everybody who tuned in.
Mm-hmm.